From the Sky News Centre at 5, the 1.2 million soldiers killed or wounded in the Battle of the Somme have been remembered in the UK and France. It's the 100th anniversary of the start of one of the bloodiest conflicts of the First World War, as Kieran Corr reports.
Those were the whistles heard in London this morning following a two-minute silence. Members of the royal family paid their respects at a ceremony in Thiepval. The Defence Secretary, Michael Fallon, was also there.
It's important more and more of us understand the sacrifice they made.
Services have also been held in Manchester.
At the going down of the sun and in the morning, we will remember them.
Nearly 20,000 British soldiers were killed on the first day of the conflict after they fought the Germans alongside French troops.
A landscape gardener has been jailed for at least 35 years for the rape and murder of a schoolgirl in Leicestershire. Stephen Biedman held Kayleigh Hayward prisoner after she was lured to the home of his neighbour. The Justice Secretary has been explaining what he'll do if he becomes Prime Minister. Michael Gove says he would put more money into the NHS, tackle excess boardroom pay and bring in an Australian-style points-based system for immigration. George Osborne has warned the UK will no longer be able to achieve a budget surplus by 2020. The Chancellor says the EU referendum result is likely to trigger a negative economic shock. That's the latest. I'm Andy Hayes.
On BCFM 93.2.
It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is Bradley Stokes, UKIP Chair Ben Walker, as well as Mike and Magda Bond, former producers and presenters of the BCFM Polish Show. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, at 87 years of age, the great Alvin Toffler is dead. His 1970s book, Future Shock, prophesied a world where technology and events would move so fast that teachers, the public and even journalists wouldn't be able to keep up. Would be so stuck in their ways and incapable of analysing or contextualising current affairs, the way could be left open for the rise again of totalitarianism. Also, Manfred Petrisch is a former Swiss investment banker turned rogue. He is now running a blog called All Smoke and Mirrors, where he dishes the dirt on Henry Kissinger, the Bilderbergers and the global elite. He explained to me earlier this week how he realised we're being ruled by a criminal elite, why we've lost the battle for democracy, and how the next world war to cover up the financial crimes is likely to start, and what we can do. Plus, it's Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Lows tonight of 11 Celsius, mostly dry and breezy. This weekend, highs of 21, sunnier on Saturday, sunshine and showers, though, on Sunday. So don't think about shopping tomorrow, go out instead. Next week, highs of 21 again, a fairly cloudy week with some showers and sunny spells. Next weekend, that's the 9th and 10th of July, highs of 21, fairly sunny with some showers. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, helping us review this week's news is Bradley Stoke, UKIP Chair, Ben Walker. Hi, Ben. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hello, Tony. Thanks for having me.
Could you, do you think, explain how you were voted in originally as a Conservative, but then decided to turn to UKIP?
Oh, wow. Okay. I've forgotten that, to be honest.
I know, it's a while ago. The thing is, I think most people, if they're voting for you as a Conservative, they would expect you to carry on your term as a Conservative, wouldn't they?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, I basically jumped ship before it became fashionable to do so, basically. And it was, I just couldn't come to terms with what the Tories stood for anymore and the backbiting and backstabbing, to be honest.
Well, just give us some examples. What specifically did you think you were standing for as a councillor that you later found you weren't?
Oh, huge amount of things. I mean, one of the biggest things that I actually, you know, I knocked people's doors for and stood on was to, you know, not affect the NHS, you know, all that sort of thing. And then as soon as the Tories get in, you get the biggest reorganisation that you can see from space. So that didn't go down too well with me.
Okay, and also, what about your relationship with Jack Lopresti, who's the local Conservative MP up Filton and Bradley-Stoke?
Obviously, I was mayor of the town at the time, and he was the, parliamentary candidate, and we helped to obviously get him elected, and then as soon as we kind of did that, I found that he was working behind the scenes to try and undermine my candidacy for a different area.
Interesting. I mean, Jack is an interesting character, isn't he? Really best known as the kind of Bedminster corrugated iron ice cream man. You can see Jack Lopresti's ice cream van up on the Downs quite often. And he also was on this programme, well, possibly 3 or 4 years ago now, promising me that he would get me the Freemason Book of Bristol, because he is a Freemason, and he promised me he'd get me that book. I'm afraid he never did get me that book. He also promised that I was going to get a tour of Freemason's Hall. I never got a tour of Freemason's Hall. I'm not sure if I'm allowed to call him a liar, but he did promise both of those things, but and I didn't get actually either of them.
Yeah, he's certainly building an interesting profile for himself. I don't really what more I can say about the guy, to be honest.
Okay, and also, what's your thoughts, Ben, about particularly this week, the running for various characters running to be Conservative leader? I mean, we announced this time last week David Cameron was standing down as leader and that the race has started. What do you think about the candidates?
Yeah, well, I think what David Cameron did, it was probably one of the most statesmanlike and dignified things that he has done in his terms as Prime Minister. I enjoyed his speech. I thought it was a good speech. He did the right thing. With the candidates coming forward, well, I mean, yeah, that it's difficult, isn't it, to try and pick a good one, to be honest. I can't see any of them that have the attributes to try and, you know, move this country forward, unite the country, and actually, more importantly for them, unite their own party.
Well, I mean, one thing that seems to be quite important from a UKIP point of view, and you are UKIP chair at Bradley-Stoke, is that that somebody who was actually part of the Leave campaign should take over the Conservative Party. But that seems to be falling by the wayside, with Theresa May being many of the grandees of the Conservative Party, including, of course, Bilderberger and Remainer Ken Clark, saying that Theresa May is the person and that Michael Gove should stand down.
Yeah, it's very interesting. I think that, you know, people have been very critical of the Leave campaign for not having a plan afterwards, but I think by the same token, the government didn't have a plan either, apart from how they were going to stop Boris. And I think that's what you're seeing in play now. I'm pretty sure that Michael Gove has been promised some nice little cushy cabinet post for doing what he's done, and I'm sure this has all been planned some time ago.
But we're finding UKIP and various other characters, including the Tory Leave campaign, is backtracking almost straight away, aren't we, on things like the pledge for £350 million a week to be going into the National Health Service.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and I think...
Why backtracking? That's not fair, is it?
No, it's not fair. And the one thing that I would say about the campaign is I was pretty disappointed from both sides of the campaign. I think it was light on facts, it was heavy on fear, and I didn't enjoy either side, you know, either side's argument, and I certainly didn't enjoy the campaign.
You were part of it.
I mean, I was part of it.
So you should influence it in the right direction.
Well, I mean, having said that, yeah, we could only do what we could locally. So basically, the campaign itself was very fractured from the beginning, and that was almost by design. So we never knew who we were working for, but locally as a branch, we did most of our stuff for the Go campaign and then Leave EU. And the most important thing for us, over and above money, over and above immigration, was actually sovereignty. And that was the thing that we championed locally.
Okay, well, I'm also joined by Magda and Mike Bond. Both of you, welcome to the show. Your thoughts initially on the vote last week?
Do you want the truth or something beautiful, as a singer once said? We're still pretty angry with it. I mean, the Leave campaign itself every little Leave campaign, because it was, as you said, it was quite fractured. Every little Leave campaign promised something different, and now the Remain campaign, it was, that is it. This is remaining. That's the thing. And so it was kind of oddly stacked. So all of these different campaigns were able to promise every little thing that wanted. And so you've got your 350 million, that pretty iffy figure, even that, on the side of a bus driving all the way around. You've got other campaigns promising, you know, immigration controls, you know, NHS. You've got all of these kind of, this kind of fractured thing. And, you know, of no wonder on Friday morning everyone's going, well, I didn't promise that. Well, somebody promised it. And even if you're not part of an official campaign, there were lots of kind of, I say, funded the UKIP kind of campaign funded by Aaron Banks, who funded a lot of those Leave campaigns. You can put they were able to say whatever they want. That was frustrating from an electorate. I know this is going to come as a surprise to Magda. Our neighbour didn't vote because she was so incredibly confused about everything that was going on. And there were so many of the messages that were coming out. You know, Leave could just go, no, that's a Project Fear. And that was repeated so many times.
Magda, I wonder what you make of all of this, because obviously yourself, as someone who's Polish, it's almost like we don't want you here. That's the kind of message that I think a lot of Eastern Europeans have got from this.
Not only Eastern Europeans, but any Europeans, really. Well, I'm gutted, I'm shocked, I'm surprised, I'm angry, I'm in despair. But I'm not losing hope because of Bristol, because well done, Bristol, 62% of you voted to remain. And this is something uplifting and positive I'm taking out of it. Because this is obviously it showed that this is the right city for me to be in. But yeah, going back to the whole campaign, the campaign started many years ago. I remember working on the Polish show on BCFM and already getting messages of incidents of people being racist. And I was thinking like, okay, maybe my natives are exaggerating a bit. Turns out they didn't, because after the result, what happened, it's like the with some people who voted to leave, the inner xenophobic or racist came out, and now it's almost in fashion to say those horrible things, which British people weren't like that before Friday. Not everyone, at least there was some sort of control. So
what about Ben's point though about sovereignty? I mean, you know, as a Polish person, are you happy for the Poles to give up their sovereignty to Brussels?
I mean, it's a big sort of word and concept you're waving with. To be honest, there's always a parliamentary election in the European Parliament. There's your vote. Go and vote. Make a difference. Instead of like, boo-hoo-hoo, oh, I can't, you know, Brussels so bad, can't do anything. Well, let's just leave it.
The MEPs can't really change anything. They don't actually make the laws. The laws made by the Commission, which is mostly these failed politicians.
Yeah, but in the UK Parliament, the MPs don't make the laws either.
They do. That's absolutely incorrect, because the British or the UK Parliament, they can actually debate and they can change legislation. The European Parliament, it just comes through and they rubber stamp it. The commissioners put that forward and it's rubber stamped through
the
Parliament.
Where do the commissioners come from?
Well, they come from the member states, but they're not elected.
Well, we don't elect many of those who behind the scenes in the UK. House of Lords is a very trite example.
I would agree. Yeah. I would agree with you on that.
And those members of the commission are appointed from elected governments.
Can I just make a point, Michael, Ben? I want you to answer this, because we're about to get a new leader of the Conservative Party who nobody has actually elected.
Yeah.
With that being the case,
if you're saying this is a democratic system, it doesn't sound very democratic.
No, it doesn't. And I would hope, I would very much hope that given the results of the EU referendum, given that they actually then go back out to the British public to get a mandate to push forward.
What about Magna's point there? Well, it's just like saying let's have another referendum on the EU.
Every single time.
Yeah, but the outcome of the EU referendum is so huge and affects every aspect of the country, its services, its sectors, whatever. no party, especially the Conservatives, even though they got, they believe they have a mandate 15 months ago, they don't have a mandate to move forward now.
But if we have a, every 5 years we have a general election, why not have a referendum every 5 years? I mean, this is what happened, for example, with the Lisbon Treaty. They kept having another go, didn't they?
Well, I mean, democracy takes time and it costs money. And I'm not against having a referenda for big issues.
I bet that if the Remain campaign would have won, UKIP would be the first one and Nigel Farage to saying, yeah, let's go for a second referendum because I don't agree with this one. So,
I don't think that's true either. And I'm not the biggest advocate of Nigel Farage, but what I would say is sometime before that he said that he wouldn't be calling for a second referendum.
That's not actually true. He was saying if it was close, within a wider margin that it was, let's have a second referendum. If it was 48 to 52. Calling for.
Let's bring Martin in here. Martin, what do you make about this? We can have a general election every 5 years, but only one ever referendum.
Well, referendums do take place from time to time in Britain. I mean, we had one over the Irish peace agreement, for example, which was a simultaneous referendum north and south of the border to ratify the agreement. And it was a necessary thing to tie everybody in, you know, because the Republicans had believed up to that point that they had a mandate dating back to the Sinn Féin Doyle of 1918, where they'd been in the majority, and the hardliners in the IRA had always said, well, that's our mandate. And of course, by the Republicans agreeing to an all-Ireland referendum on the peace agreement, that took away that particular prop of Republican history. So, you know, referendums can be uniting as well as dividing. It just depends how they play out. I mean, it's just part of the political game, isn't it?
Well, it's not surely a game. I mean, this is actually how you're supposed to run a country. It was invented by the Greeks, I think.
Well, the British political system is absolutely sclerotic. We need PR. We got PR in Northern Ireland as a result of the fact that
This is proportional representation.
Proportional representation.
Because actually, most European countries have that.
Well, most European countries do have it. And, of course, what would have happened if we had proportional representation at the last election? It was for the very first time in British history you would have had a right-wing majority, because UKIP and Tory votes together would have been enough to form a government. But that certainly wasn't true during the Thatcher era, where in actual fact the left, if you count the Greens, this SDLP, the SNP, etc., Plaid Cymru, and Liberals, we've always had a majority which we never were able to do anything about. Thatcher was able to do all the things she did on a minority of the vote, and the current Conservative government has got all power, and they're now electing a new leader on the basis of something like 30% of the vote, if that.
Now, you've just used the word sclerotic, which is, yes, I have to agree with you. Sometimes looking at the system, it's just not working. But we're sitting in a country where last year we had a general election, where now between 15 and 20 of the constituencies, it looks like the Conservative Party overspent and did fraudulent accounts when they were reporting in those constituencies.
Well, in particular, they targeted that at the UKIP constituencies. So I think that's something that's going to run, hopefully. I think, looking at the positive side of this is, if we'd had a Tory UKIP government under PR, then we would definitely have had a referendum.
Yeah.
And it would, and the result was likely to be as it is. I'm a bit surprised by the Welsh, frankly. I mean, I was reading in the newspapers
about
a Welsh town.
You're disappointed.
I'm just saying there's a Welsh town whose name I've forgotten, where they've got the highest EU subsidy in Britain anywhere because of they get Objective One status and so on, and they voted to leave the EU. And it's like, well, if you want to do that, that's fine, but who do you think is going to fund your community centres after that? Do you think Michael Gove is going to dig into his pocket for you?
I think, the answer to that is because people were voting against the immigration. People are, in the last few years, upset about the numbers of migrants coming in, whether from Europe or from outside of Europe, and they were just scared. So that was the fear factor, and basically vote to leave, so you vote against the immigration. And then you've got on Friday already people saying to other people, oh, come on, leave our country, get on the bus. Well, I'm sorry, I'm not leaving anywhere. It's my country as well.
Just to say, I completely agree, and I understand that immigration has been used as quite a hot ticket throughout this whole debate, and I don't think it should have been. But actually, it's a little bit unfair to say, especially if we're talking about the Welsh, that it was just about immigration. Actually, I think it's people feeling disenfranchised from the political system as it is. They just feel it doesn't represent them, they can't engage with it, and it's kind of a vote against them. It's kind of an up yours to the system kind of thing.
So basically the referendum often has been voted on. They're not voting for the thing that is on the ballot paper. They're voting for some other problem.
Well, no, they are. I get what you're saying, but they are voting for that as well, because an up yours to the system is an up yours to the EU. They're part of the system. We've already got a system which is difficult enough to engage with for your average person, and then broad brushed along the top of that, you've got the EU. And it's very hard for people to just try and get their head around how politics works, to be honest.
Martin has said something there about proportional representation. I wonder what Mike and Magda, what you make of that, because in our general elections, it is this first-past-the-post system actually discards tens of millions of votes, doesn't it?
Yeah, the problem you got with proportional representation in this country is you've got to change the political attitudes, first of all, because there's no incentive that no one works together. Everyone's fighting. Everyone, you see it in Parliament and Prime Minister's Question Times. I mean, they're just having a whale of a time, just shouting and screaming.
Well, even within the parties,
yes,
fighting.
Exactly. And with proportional representation, you've got to have an attitude of working together. And frankly, sometimes it just doesn't happen, even in those other countries. But because they've had that history of proportional representation, they're kind of forced to work with it, and they sometimes get along and sometimes don't. But with the current attitudes of the MPs, you know, you just couldn't work with it. We had the first hint of something that was a coalition, and you saw what happened with that.
Can I just say, Tony, I used to work in Poland, and I went to the Sejm in Poland, and if you see, in Poland, the Sejm is a circular building, and they sit in a circle, and then when you enter into
it
the...
It sounds a bit kumbaya.
But I mean, it was built after the changes as a main, as a means of, you know, expressing the new political order in Poland. And so the gangway to come in separates the far right from the far left, so they can't scrap with each other. And of course, if you go into the chamber, you can speak for 10 minutes, and you get 10 minutes to speak, and they just get up, and they trundle through their speech, nobody's listening, they then press the button and they go away. And in actual fact, it's like watching paint dry. But in actual fact, what's actually happening is people are all in their offices around the building, keeping half an eye on what's going on in the chamber, where you're just getting stuff on the record, doing deals with each other behind the scenes, because that's how PR works. And PR does force you to say to people, as in Ireland, I have to say, if you're not going to vote for me as your first preference, do consider me as a second preference, which means that you don't have to actually slag each other off to the same extent, because you're actually trying to persuade people who are not completely on board with you to come on board with you. So you then change your style. You have to.
Well, I imagine this whole idea of proportional representation is something that, if it does come along, is going to break the consensus, so-called consensus, it's like a kind of cartel consensus that Ben was talking about earlier. But unelected by anybody apart from his own constituents, one of the people who looks like they may be in the line to become the new Prime Minister is Michael Gove. So let's have a listen to what he had to say earlier to the BBC.
I thought it was right that, following the decision that the British people took last week, that we should have someone leading the Conservative Party and leading the country who believed in their heart and soul that Britain was better off outside the European Union. And I hoped that Boris Johnson would be someone who could ensure that the government followed the instructions of the British people and also build and unite a team around him in order to lead this country forward. And Boris is an amazing and an impressive person, but I've realised in the last few days that Boris isn't capable of building that team and providing that unity. And so I came reluctantly but firmly to the conclusion that, as someone who had argued from the beginning that we should leave the European Union, and as someone who wanted to ensure that a bold, positive vision for our future was implemented, that I had to stand for the leadership of the Conservative Party. I would want to be captain of a strong team. The first thing to do is to recognise that we need to draw on all the talents that the Conservative Party has. Indeed, we need to draw on all the talents in the country. I want to lead a government in which people with wise heads and generous hearts work together in order to ensure that the decision that the British people made on the European Union is honoured. That means that, first and foremost, we need to take this country out of the European Union and into the world. We need to restore parliamentary control of our borders, taxes and laws. But above all, we need to build a much more dynamic economy and a fairer society. When people voted to leave the European Union last week, they were voting for change. And there are far too many people in our country who felt that recent economic growth and renewed prosperity hasn't touched their lives. There are far too many people in this country who felt left behind and overlooked as the world moves forward at a faster pace. I want to govern for everyone in this country. I want to heal and unite. And above all, I want to ensure that Britain is a country that others look to with admiration, because we're the home of innovation and creativity, but we're also a warm and compassionate place that everyone is proud to call home.
That's the candidate for the leader of the Conservative Party and Prime Minister, Michael Gove, there speaking to the BBC earlier. What do you make? I think we'll start with you, Ben Walker, UKIP chair in Bradley Stoke. What do you make of Gove's prospects? Because really, it's a bit of a bombshell, old Boris pulling out. I mean, what do you make of all of that?
I really don't know what to make of it, to be honest. I said earlier, I think it's been a done deal for a while. I think they knew they were going to do this. But I don't honestly believe that Gove wants the job. I don't think he wants it at all. That's my feeling.
Why do you say that?
Well, because he has been, he's been on TV on numerous occasions saying he didn't want the job.
Yeah, but they all say that, don't they?
Yeah, but him in particular.
And, I think you've got to watch anyone that says, I really do not wish to become Prime Minister.
Yeah.
You know, I'm being forced to do this.
But it is a strange one, and I know that he was one of the leading lights for Vote Leave. But he has got a tainted past himself, hasn't he, with his issues over schools and stuff when he was the Minister for Education. You've got this email from his wife at the moment, which is kind of pulling the trigger. I don't know whether it's
Some people have said he's got rid of thousands of prison officers.
Yeah.
He's got rid of 17,000 police officers. Oh, that's Theresa May that's done that.
Yeah,
actually, yes. That's not him. And privatised something like 20,000 schools. So, you know, is this the guy that is really going to lead the country?
I don't believe he is. I mean, I want to see a Brexit leader, a new leader. That's what I would like to see. And the trouble is, we're picking from a really bad bunch. I think the only person that I would really put any weight behind is Andrea Leadsom, who I think will be a well-balanced leader and a woman, which is, again, a good thing, I think, at this time.
OK, Mike and Magda, what do you make of the various candidates? Is it really feasible to have someone who is a fence-sitter during the campaign to take over the Tory party now?
Well, what you've got, if you look at the referendum results, it was close. I mean, in terms of the percentages. And so you need someone who is neutral. You can't really have someone who is definitely leave because the Remains will hate them. You can't have someone who is, in vice versa. Okay, so I mean, the current, I think, favourite is Theresa May. Okay, now that is someone who has just today has basically said she wants to use EU citizens in the UK as hostages, in the negotiation process. And so, from our perspective, that's no better than any of the others.
I think most journalists in a country want to shoot Theresa May anyway because of what she's doing with the Snoopers Charter, which is spying on journalists, spying on MPs, spying on MPs, on lawyers. And so when you're going to chat to your lawyer about some court case that's coming up, she wants the GCHQ and the National Security Agency to be able to spy on you. So that's another side of Theresa May, which is a little bit chilling. Anyway, Magda, what do you
mean? Yeah, she's a really nosy woman, huh? Untypically British, then, isn't it? And when I listened to that speech by Michael Gove, I think as much as I sort of dislike him, he picked up on something that's important and might explain the whole result, is people want change. It doesn't matter what change, they want something happening. And the same thing happened in Poland when in October 2015 people went to vote for new government, and despite the years of really decent life and we had freedom, we didn't have any communism anymore, suddenly people voted in a very right-wing party. And the funniest thing out of all of that is that it's the people in their 20s voted for almost a nationalistic party, whereas it's the other way around in Britain, in a way. So I think there's a wave of upset.
Well, no, it's the same, surely. It's exactly the same.
Yeah.
People are voting effectively for UKIP when they're in the referendum, but not when it was a general election. What do you put this down to? Because it's sending a message to Brussels, look, you're not getting it right. You sort yourself out, otherwise everybody's going to leave, and maybe Brexit is going to only be the first one.
And I think they should be rightly afraid of it. And to be honest, I think we need people, sort of normal citizens, getting more involved with Brussels and its structures.
But they don't seem to be, do they? This is, I mean, we had earlier in the year, right at the beginning of the year, David Cameron going, basically begging on his knees to Merkel and Hollande, saying, please, we need some real change in our relationship with the EU. And they just basically stuck two fingers up on him, didn't they? Told him where to go.
Well, me and Michael can go and sort them out, huh?
You can try. Anyway, Martin, what do you make of Michael Gove and his candidacy and what he had to say there?
Well, I think the political meat to this is that Bojo was suggesting was that he would go for the option. You were talking about fence sitters. He was talking about we'll stay in the single European market and therefore we'll probably have to accept what Angela Merkel has made absolutely plain. If you want to be in the single European market, you've got to accept free movement of labour, because that's what everybody else has got to accept. And I think that would have been a halfway house. But I think, you see, Murdoch and Paul Dacre at the Daily Mail and the people who and UKIP by and large do not want to accept free movement of labour. I think even, you know, that you don't solve the immigration problem by saying people can't come. The US says loads of people can't come from Mexico and Guatemala, but they do come because their economies have been destroyed by 30 years of Reaganite policies in that region. And the same thing also happened in Eastern Europe. What happened in Poland before they joined the European Union was that the Thatcherite policies pursued by Balcerowicz put most of the country on the dole. And then, of course, they were told that, you know, what you do, you've got to get on your bike and come to Britain or wherever it is. I think most people don't realise what was at stake. And now Gove has made it quite clear he wants to leave the single European market. Now, that means, ultimately, that we're going to have a hard border in Ireland and possibly a hard border in Scotland, although that's receding now after Sturgeon got knocked back by Rajoy from Spain and so on. But all of these big questions are still rolling around, and of course we've still not talked about the real problem, which is the banking system. Deutsche Bank were nearly crashed this time last year when the Greeks threatened to leave the euro, and the Greeks, who are much more politically educated than the British, realised what they were doing. They were threatening to leave the euro, repudiate their private sector debts, which had been transferred to the European Central Bank, and that would have crashed the European banking system, pulling down the American banking system after it. The people running Syriza, with a majority of the Greek population, didn't have the courage for that, which is why Varoufakis resigned from the government and came over here to campaign for Remain. But the fact is that the British, what happened was that Steinmeier and the Germans forced the Greeks to knuckle under and recognise that they couldn't just crash the banking system. Everybody's too scared of crashing it. And then Boris Johnson turns up and presses the button anyway. Bang! The bank. What's going to happen over the next few weeks is as Italy's bond spread goes up.
Remind listeners that Martin has been saying this since 2008.
The effect on the pigs has been, you know, that Poland, Italy, Greece, Spain has been disastrous. Yeah, and what will happen is they will ultimately be forced out of the euro, which will crash Deutsche Bank, which will crash the world economy. So don't forget that the Japanese stock market went down the drain because Britain voted for Brexit. Most people in Britain, I don't suppose, in Sunderland or in South Wales, had much thought about what would happen to the Japanese stock market when they voted. But that's the world we're in. And we haven't been talking about the banks for 5 and 10 years.
Well, George,
we should have been talking.
George
we should
Osborne
have been talking
today,
about them, but we haven't been talking
Martin,
about them.
George Osborne today was talking about the banks, and he said as a result of Brexit, it looks like he won't be able to balance the books by 2020 now.
Well, that's not just about the banks. Of course, Royal Bank of Scotland and Lloyds are not going to be privatised anytime soon because their share values have gone down
but
by
30%.
What
do you make of his announcement today?
Well, what it means is, when he said we're going to balance the budget and we're going to pass a law to make us balance the budget, I said, well, that's like passing a law saying we want sunny weather. You can't pass a law like that. Inevitably, if there is a crash, the deficit will increase. And rightly so, because if it didn't increase, the crash just intensifies. The purpose of having a welfare state is not just to help the poor, it also cushions the economy from shocks. And those countries which have a good welfare state, the northern European countries like Sweden and Finland and so on, they survive shocks better than those that don't have one. I mean, in Greece, there is no proper unemployment benefit. You've got 60% unemployment for under 25s. They are living on their parents' and grandparents' pensions because there's no unemployment benefits. And that makes the economy incredibly vulnerable. Now, we've actually sawed away at our benefits over the last 30 years, and when the crash comes, the people at the bottom will feel the pinch.
I guess if we had been part of the euro, Magda, we might be in the same situation as the Greeks with this mass unemployment.
Yes, I think so. I mean, to be honest, in Poland, there was never like a welfare system anyway in the first place. So if you didn't have a job, tough luck, basically. And maybe that also explains why Polish people are more prepared just to leave their own country and go and try to get a job elsewhere. Because if you were unemployed, the government wasn't looking after you as it does in Britain. It has changed now because the new government offered something like a child benefit. Thanks to that, they also won elections. But it's interesting, yet a bit scary times to be living in right now, I think. So,
what do you make of the this one of the main calls, which has been that people, for example, there was a whole massive load of migration to Britain in the 1950s and 1960s, mostly from the Commonwealth, mm-hmm. from Pakistan, from Asia, from the West Indies. I mean, I've spoken to some people and heard other people talking about this, saying, well, look, a lot of the original migrants to Britain in the 50s and 60s have said, well, it's taken us decades to establish ourselves and to get a decent living here in Britain, and now we've got people from Eastern Europe coming, taking our jobs.
Well, to be honest, the job I applied for, there was no queue. I think I was the only person. Nobody wanted that job many years ago. Actually, I'm not going to apologize for it. There was a job offer. I applied. I went for the interview, for the whole procedure. I got it because there was no other person interested in it. And I think a lot of Polish people do not come here for benefits. A lot of Polish people come here because they know they will get fairness. In Poland, quite often when you want to get a job, it's about connections, knowing people, having sort of your back covered. Whereas Britain offers a fairly fair process of, this is the application form, this is the interview, I need the references, there you go, there is a job. So I wouldn't say Polish people are coming here for benefits. And to be honest, if I think about Polish people I know, none of them got any benefits, because in a way it would be embarrassing. I mean, I would be personally embarrassed to phone my parents and say, oh yeah, mom, so after studying now I'm on benefits. My goodness, they would just rip me apart on the phone.
So what's your own situation? Are you, I mean, because actually you're married to Michael, so probably you're okay to stay, are you?
Well, I don't know. I don't have a British passport, which costs £1,000 for a EU member to get, and £3,000, I think, pounds for a non-EU member to get. I think I will be now trying to apply for a British passport. But yet again, I'm thinking, like, why do people assume that if you've got British passport, you're suddenly like a better person? It just doesn't make a difference. I've been living here for 10 years, paying taxes, not going to NHS, because I do believe in paracetamol, Lemzip, go Lemzip. And I've been a good citizen. So there's a lot of Polish people and other Latvian and Spanish and so on living like that. You might get a small percentage that are sort of misrepresenting us in the right-wing press, but most of us just stick to the rules. We play by the rules.
Could you maybe tell us about some of your other Polish friends and how it's affected them?
Well, I can tell you that, for instance, people with Polish first name or Polish surnames who were even born here are suddenly being challenged when having a conversation, or people whose accents you can hear that there's not a Bristolian accent, or there's not a British accent in their speech, they're being challenged, and not jokes, because it's not a joke anymore now, just to, oh, get your suitcase packed and off you go. The school I work in, which is an inner city secondary school, I had some of our kids, Polish kids, they're asking me, oh, miss, what's going to happen? And I have to say, well, actually, you know what? I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen, because, and they were saying, like, oh, we've been here like 2 years or 3 years, so that's not enough for residency. So what will happen to us? And those are kids who already speak English, who are studying towards GCSEs, and who are part of the society and the sort of the British landscape here.
Ben, this isn't very British. It's not very fair, is it, to invite people over to come and work here and then tell them thank you very much, off you go.
No, I quite agree. Again, it's one of the whole argument about, EU migrants coming across and taking all our benefits. I think that's an outrageous argument, and I cannot believe that it's even been used, because for all the, if we're talking about Eastern Europeans, they have got to be, obviously, and listening to you as well, some of the hardest working people that I've ever come across in my life. And I get quite frustrated with this, because I don't believe they're coming over to take jobs. Well, yeah, okay, they're coming over here where they're taking jobs, but like you quite rightly said, no one else is going for it. And there's a bigger problem here as well. We have, I'll use the term, indigenous British people, if you like, What are they doing? Why have we still got 1.7 million people that are unemployed? You know, that there's a bigger question to ask there. So you can't then just turn around and blame EU migrants that they're taking all our jobs and taking our benefits. I think it's just nuts.
Martin, this has got something surely to do with the fact that the economy's not actually doing very well and the jobs just simply aren't there for everybody.
Well, let's just make...
And the actual amount of money people are getting per week is not enough.
Well, real wages haven't risen in a long time. That's true for various reasons. But let's just make another point. The demographic of the people who've come here are the ones that are paying into the system rather than taking out. So there's no doubt whatsoever that the younger, more mobile, educated people from Poland and elsewhere who've come here are contributing more than they are taking out. When they get old, it might change around, but at the minute, that's the situation. And of course, in many ways, that's not such a good thing for the countries they come from. It's what used to happen in Ireland and Poland before the war, which is that and still happens in to some extent in peripheral countries, where local people pay taxes to educate their young people, and then those people go with all of their skills, and they never participate in their own country. And I was actually involved in discussions about what should happen in the Polish economy after the changes in 1990, and that was before Poland was in the EU. And in actual fact, I was working with Marek Kuchelski from Warsaw University, and we went to see John Fleming, the head of the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development, to talk about a Polish strategy, which would have been not a full-on free market strategy, because you're trying to reform what is a communist economy. You've got to start with what you've got, not just say this is all rubbish and start again. You've got to look at what you've got and think how you can make it work. Anyway, I knew what would happen when we went to the meeting. John Fleming just laughed in our faces and said, well, you're never going to be allowed to do that.
Fleming, of course, being the banking family that Ian Fleming was a member of.
Well, I don't know whether John Fleming...
James Bond author.
I don't know whether
he was. Yeah.
John Fleming was
the same family.
Anyway, the point he was making is that we wouldn't be allowed to do that. And what Marek used to argue is we want to join the European Union in the long run. But it was the British in particular who pushed the idea that the European Union should be expanded rapidly in order to... basically for geopolitical reasons, to get them out of the Russian orbit and all the rest of it. So a lot of decisions were made at that time, which were political decisions, which had no real economic rationale. And that's why, along with the euro not being flexible enough and so on, we've ended up with the mess we're in. But leaving all of that aside, the fundamental problem in 2008 was in Lehman Brothers in New York. And that is still the centre of the world financial system. But of course, what will happen as these dominoes go down is that we're all going to be thrown into a massive global crisis of a kind that we haven't seen for a long, long time. And of course, that is what we should have been discussing at the last election in Britain. But instead, we're talking about Brexit, which in actual fact, in my view, is rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic either way.
Okay, well, we'll be having a listen in a minute to, we'll be just discussing some of the strange goings on over the weekend and the Labour Party coup. With John McDonnell speaking today to sort of try and consolidate, I suppose, Jeremy Corbyn's leadership. But first, let's have a look at a couple of stories that are just sort of in the local and national news. But first of all, child poverty is rising, because we can often forget these with the Brexit and the bigger matters. Child poverty rises by 200,000 on the previous year, official figures show. Child poverty has risen by 200,000 children over the past year. The numbers released today as the government faced paralysis in the wake of the EU referendum show 29% of children are now classed as being in poverty. The households below average income statistics published by the Department for Work and Pensions reveal 3.9 million children are now in families struggling to make ends meet. Of those families, two-thirds, that's 66%, have at least one adult in work, with poverty now no longer being the preserve of the jobless. So the message here, I guess I'll start with you, Ben Walker, is the idea that you can get a job, but it isn't actually going to be provide enough money for you to live on.
No, I think that's absolutely true. I read a short story about this figure at the beginning of the week, and I was shell-shocked. I mean, you kind of know, you know it's going on, but when you read it, it's, you know, it's an official report. It's not good reading. And I think, you know, Martin's touched on it again. It's just, you know, wages haven't increased for, I don't even know how long. Do you, Martin? I
mean, real wages in the United States haven't risen since 1973.
I mean, that's outrageous, isn't it?
Well, that's that's why you've got a crisis.
Yeah, absolutely.
In the old days, as productivity increased with technology, you then that's raised wages are raised automatically through trade union power and so on. But that means the people have got the money to buy the stuff they've produced, and of course it's very good profitable for the financial system that they don't. But ultimately, they then have to be lent money to buy the stuff that they used to buy with their own money, and that can't be
people
can,
just
can't,
don't
can't
have disposable
that.
Incomes under these sorts of circumstances. Anyway, Mike and Magda, what do you make of this? 200,000 more children in poverty.
Well, I can say that in the school where I work, in Bristol, we do provide free breakfast for all students. I think we've managed to get some funding from the government within the last 2 years. And it is a very popular meal. And there's a lot of kids coming for 8 o'clock queuing to get some toast or some bacon bread roll and some baked beans. So it is used, and I think it's needed. It does make a difference for a child to start their school day with a full stomach. We do also have quite a few of children on free school meals. That sort of shows you what sort of area we're maybe targeting.
But both of you, what about sorting this out? Because we can't continue down this line. We're going to end up with three quarters of the children in the country living in poverty. How are we going to deal with this? Any thoughts from either of you, Michael?
I think very simply, we've just got to get better jobs out there. I mean, I think that is ultimate solution. I mean, if increasing benefits is really just sticking plaster over a problem. Increasing benefits is great if you're caught between a rock and a hard place. Fantastic. But I think ultimately we need to be focusing at looking at the bomb. We need to be thinking about training. You know, university education needs to be made affordable. And if you've got people who are properly trained up, they can do proper jobs.
But Martin, I mean, most of the employers and public sector will say, well, we just simply don't have the money to pay people enough.
Well, that's not true. I think the austerity agenda is gradually unravelling here, because it just, you can't do it. Go on.
No, and it's just about you're talking about kind of jobs. The company I work with, we offer paid internships. It's enough a little bit of a wage to do it. We can't fill it. We can't get the people with just the skills below the level we need. And we will train them up. We will get them too. But they need to be of a certain skill level, and we just can't get them. We eventually fill them by looking at other pieces, but we just don't get the applicants for it who can even do that kind of basic. And this is why I think training is so important. It's not an easy fix. It's not something for now. It's something for the future. And if you look at something like the German system, which has technical schools which are respected, if you go on a technical stream or an academic stream, you're viewed in a fairly in a good light. Not in the UK, where if you go to a technical school, well, it's just a dumping ground for anyone and everything.
Okay, another story. Sorry to interrupt you there, but we've got to move on. Parents that have been let down by Bristol Children's Hospital's cardiac ward. Children receiving cardiac treatment at Bristol Children's Hospital repeatedly given poor care, and parents were let down, a review has found. Independent report revealed nurses were regularly under pressure, and there was poor communication with families. Well, there's a vast amount of poor communication coming out of United Hospital Bristol's NHS Trust, chaired by John Savage, who's a Labour Party local big wig in the Labour Party, also a former master of the Merchant Venturers, spending something like £500 million of our money every year on our hospitals. But bad communication is one thing when you're spending more on building contracts to make the outside of the hospital look nice, but you're not making sure that there are nurses by children's beds who've just had heart operations. This is not good, Ben, is it?
No, it's not. It's a terrible story. I mean, I don't know too much about the details of the building for Bristol Hospital, but if it's anything like Southmead, you've got a building that's owned by Carillion, and in the end they're going to have to pay for the building four times over. And
it's just a private finance.
Yeah, and to change a light bulb, it costs about £250. And you've got these trusts shouting from the rooftops how great their hospitals are, but yet they can't even supply basic care for the most needy, which I just think is terrible. The massive problem with this is it's just going to carry on and on and on. You know, the parents shouted and screamed. They wanted a review. They got a review, but the review just consists of regurgitated information.
Martin?
Yeah, well, I think the fundamental point is the things like the private finance initiative and the creation of the internal market in the National Health Service back in the day. I make the case on this show every week. There is a case for central planning. Mm. Not everything should be decided by a market interaction. Markets are expensive. You've got far more people pushing paper now than before because they've got this supposed internal market. But of course, the danger is it's going to be opened up to being an external market. And if we sign the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, which you haven't mentioned, all of these things will then be open to challenge if you don't open it up, and so on and so forth. And of course, interestingly enough, I would like to ask Michael Gove, if he was on this show, does he intend to sign the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, as many right-wing Tories do? Peter Lilly doesn't, actually, which is very interesting. Mm. Because in that case, what's the point of leaving the EU if you're going to sign up to the trade deal that the EU's done with the Americans anyway, and so we're just going to be in the same boat with everything run by Washington and Brussels? I mean, surely we should just knock the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership into touch at this point. And Manuel Valls, who's the finance minister in France, who's facing off these big strikes at the minute, he said that TTIP's dead. So maybe it
is. One of the things that really bothers me about this story is that we're in a situation where the merchant venturers, the former slave traders, are now sitting in very key positions in many of our public services. For example, well, you would call it a public service, Bristol Water. We had the guy on here who was last year's, Chris Curling, last year's master of the merchant venturers, helping to run Bristol Water, making a vast amount of money of what used to be public utilities.
Well, indeed. Well, the merchant venturers are our local version of that parasitic class. They are a parasitic class, let's be clear. In Ireland, there was massive demonstrations a couple of years ago when people had to pay for water at all, because in Ireland, water was free, literally free. But in Britain, I live in a bedsit and I have to pay £40 a month for a shower. Ridiculous.
Absolutely insane. Anyway, we're going to talk about the Labour coup in a moment. But first of all, I was listening out for it all over the airwaves. Even went and switched on BBC Parliament, BBC News. Nowhere was it to be seen. The Shadow Chancellor, John McDonnell's talk today, where he gave a press conference about the Labour coup attempt, which was started by Hilary Benn last weekend.
We've had the resignations, and I find it really disappointing. Just at a time when our country needs us and people need to step up to the plate, now's not the time to stand down. I just say that. To behave responsibly, do your job. Wouldn't it all be better if people just came back and worked with us? So the appeal from me is to everyone calm down, think of the interests of the party, yes, but the country more importantly, and come back and start working with us again. People out there can understand what's going on when our country needs us so much. And also, let's be a bit party political, when the Tories are in such disarray as well. This is the golden opportunity for us that we should choose. It's on the basis of a relatively recent invention by the Greeks. It's called democracy. James is the leader of the Labour Party. He's staying leader of the Labour Party. And if there is a challenge, there'll be a democratic election. Jeremy will stand. He's automatically on the ballot paper under our rules. He'll stand. I think he'll win. The media, sorry if I get, this isn't me paranoid, but the stories that went round a few weeks ago that I was building a plot to oust Jeremy and replace him. This week, the story is I'm forcing him to stay. Now, we've got to get this right somewhere along the line. So let me just make it absolutely clear. I will never stand for leader of the Labour Party. If Jeremy is challenged and there's a leadership campaign, I will chair his campaign committee. Full stop.
That's the Shadow Chancellor, Labour's John McDonnell there. Martin, would you like to explain what's been going on for us? Because I don't know if even the coup plotters really understand what they're trying to do.
Well, I mean, don't ask me what the coup plotters are trying to do. It's becoming clear. I mean, in the last week, 60,000 new members of the Labour Party have appeared. And one of them is somebody I work with. And I can tell you now, he didn't join the Labour Party in the last week to get rid of Jeremy Corbyn. And I don't suppose any of that 60,000 did. There is a precedent for this situation. The Labour Party in New Zealand split in the 1980s. Now, I don't want to split. I think what McDonnell was trying to do there is try to mend fences with those who've gone through with this coup attempt. But the fact, and all three Labour MPs in Bristol have gone along with this attempt, which is an actual fact, going to my mind, is going to cause a lot of ructions. But what he's trying to do now is, because there hasn't been a leadership challenge yet, and Maria Angela Eagle, who was suggesting that she might, has held back. And it may be that there won't be one, because in actual fact, the way I see it, under existing Labour Party rules, there is no way a challenger to Jeremy Corbyn is going to win.
I noticed
at
one
all.
Of the, one
no
of the,
chance.
One of the new team,
whatsoever.
After all these mass resignations, one of the new team is Paul Flynn, Labour MP for Newport, who's now, I think, for the oldest member of the shadow government since Gladstone.
Well,
he's 87 years old, and he's now in that position. I mean, it's rather interesting.
Well, that's because all of these people have ruled themselves out by resigning.
Also,
but Paul Flynn's very good, actually. He's one of the best constituency MPs. Very solid socialist. I'm very happy for him to be in
also
the shadow cabinet.
Worth pointing out that Angela Eagle resigned, citing Hilary Benn's dismissal as her reason, but she set up a website called Angela for Leader 2 days before that, and this has led a lot of people to look at what's really been going on here. And a very good article by Nafiz Ahmed, Blairite PR firm tied to Labour coup, knew of mass resignation pact 6 months ago. Effectively, what they're saying here is that this Portland Communications PR firm has actually been orchestrating this coup from behind the scenes, along with people from the Fabian Society. Now, certainly would suggest, and I'll put a link on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Okay, people have a little bit of a look at this. But Martin, I mean, maybe the truth of the matter is that there's been a resentment that's against Jeremy Corbyn by people who are kind of friendly with Hilary Benn since the Syria bombing vote last year.
Well, it goes back further than that. Angela Eagle voted to go to war with Iraq. And in actual fact, we've kind of got over that. We were mad as hell about that, mad as hell. And of course the Chilcot report is coming out very shortly, and it will be a whitewash, but it will remind people of what a terrible decision that was. The decision to go to war in Iraq is probably the worst decision by a British Prime Minister since Munich. And it's led to an absolute disaster and catastrophe in the Middle East. Every day in Baghdad, people are dying. And in Syria and elsewhere, and that's our responsibility. It's the Labour Party's responsibility. The most of the a substantial chunk of the Labour Party didn't go along with it, and we told people who did go along with it, it may take us years to get you, but we will get you, and we will get them. They've come out of the closet here. And Hilary Benn's speech. Can I just make a comment about that? What I'm going to say to Angela Eagle or anybody else who stands is, do you know what Roland Dumas, the former French foreign minister, said about this? He said, I was approached by the British before the Arab Spring, said, we're going to run an armed uprising in Syria. Do you want to participate? So we have prima facie evidence that the British started the war in Syria.
That's not so much prima facie evidence.
No, we're going to row about
hearsay.
This.
Hearsay. But anyway, Michael and then Ben.
Yeah, I just want to add that it's not entirely a coup that people want Corbyn to go. I am a Labour supporter. And I found Corbyn to be a weak leader, especially over this referendum thing. He was so lukewarm, he was almost invisible throughout the entire process. So it's not just, there's a, you know, everyone
Ben,
for Corbyn.
Ben, we're just coming up to the hour, so Ben, what's your
thoughts? Yeah, I mean, it's very interesting for me to watch in. I've got no real view on leadership of the Labour Party either way, but for me it just shows you that actually the Labour Party is really split into three divisions.
Martin,
now.
Finally, is there going to be a challenge or not?
I think they will, and they're going to lose.
Okay, thanks very much to our guests, and that was the chair of Bradley Stoke UKIP. That's Ben Walker, also Mike and Magda Bond, former producers and presenters of the BCM.